Open your Bible, please, to the book of Genesis. And my apologies, I was thinking services started at 7:30. So I thought I was here in good time. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Drop down to verse 11. God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, fruits bearing fruit in which there is their seed, each according to its kind." And dropping down further, God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds." And then after you have birds and fish and beasts of the field, God also said, "Let us make man in our image, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. So you have plants created, and they're to produce after their kind. Animals are to produce after their kind, and distinctly from that, man is created, man and woman. Now, as you know, if you go, if you listen to the sources in the educational system, if you listen to the majority of the scientists, if you are watching PBS or Nova or National Geographic special, or a number of other sources, or if you go in your university over here or another university, you're going to run into a lot of people who are going to tell you, of course, that that is a myth, and I don't have something right here. Let me see if this one will work. We'll be told that that's a myth, and that it's been refuted by Darwin and the theory of evolution. And so tonight we're going to look at Darwin's theory of evolution. Darwin was a talented naturalist. We're going to learn a little bit about him, learn a little bit about his theory. And he got a lot of things, I think, right, and he got some things absolutely fundamentally wrong. And we're going to look at the difference in that. Tomorrow night, we're going to look at a separate argument that's often presented, and that is the different skull lineups. If you've ever been to a museum or looked at a textbook and they had Neanderthal skulls, Homo erectus skulls, Australopithecine skulls, like Lucy. Well, Lucy didn't have much of a skull left. She was mostly body bones. But if you've ever looked at those and wondered about those, we're going to be talking about those tomorrow night. Use the mouse? All right, we'll use the mouse. That'll work. All right. So, tonight we're going to talk about Charles Darwin, the origin of the species. Then we're specifically going to talk about the issue of species, and then the difference between micro and macroevolution. Species is an idea that goes way, 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 way back, before Carol Linnaeus. But Carol Linnaeus is a Swedish naturalist from the 1700s, who established the Latin binomial classification. That's where, if you ever remember watching Roadrunner when you were a little kid, and it showed the coyote, and it would give a Latin name for him, like Giganticus Appetitus or something, and then the Roadrunner, like Fastius Tastius or something. That was a play off these Latin double names, Homo sapiens, okay? And so one part of it gives the family that you're in, and the other part gives the species. And he gave this binomial classification. And he and a lot of others originally thought that each of these was specifically created. Now, here's kind of how it works. I think most everybody here can look at that picture and tell what that is. That's a rattlesnake, right? But what species of rattlesnake? That one happens to be a Crotalus or a Ganis. Now, there's lots of rattlesnakes in the genus Crotalus, and they classify them in different species. So here you've got Crotalus atrox. Here you've got Crotalus mitchellii, subspecies Stephensi. Here you've got Crotalus ruber. Here you've got Crotalus oreganus, Hellery. Here you've got Crotalus oreganus, oreganus. The third thing is subspecies. Here you've got Crotalus scutellutus, or whatever that is. All right, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And these are, if I remember correctly, yeah, these are all just in California. So these are different species of rattlesnakes in California. Do you need to believe that God created every one of those variety of rattlesnakes separately? No. Now, but at the time, one of the things that Darwin, watch as you see what Darwin did. Darwin was, he was born on the same day, same year, same month, same day as Abraham Lincoln, in very different circumstances. And his grandfather was kind of an evolutionist, but Charles, his father wanted him to be like a country clergyman. But he spent more of his time out shooting rats and sporting and out observing nature and studying bugs and different things. And when he went to school, he would go out with the biologist and they'd study bugs and different things, and it fascinated him. And later, when a ship captain was going to be taking the HMS Beagle around the world, Darwin was taken along to be a naturalist. So off he goes on the Beagle. And they sail away, and he would collect samples of natural life that he would find. He would find fossils, like an anteater skull that was larger but still similar to modern anteaters. He would see different types of birds that were unusual, iguanas and such. And when he gets here to the Galapagos Islands in particular, found a lot of interesting animals, and one of the more famous was his finches, now known as Darwin's finches. And as you can see, some of them are smaller and some of them are bigger. Some of you are smaller, some of you are bigger. Some of them have big beaks, some of them have smaller beaks. And on different islands and in different places and different locations, of course, that suited these different types of finches for different types of habitat or eating. For example, and we'll show you a chart on that in a minute. Well, let's back up and go ahead and do that now. No, we'll do it in a minute because I don't know. I'll go backwards on this. All right. On the anteater fossil, he said, the extinct animal bore every mark of being ancestor to the modern living animal. If it was, then every species on Earth could not have been separately created by elemental atoms suddenly flashing into specialized tissues. Many years later, Darwin recalled in his autobiography, this was the moment when he fully faced the revolutionary, disturbing thought, the moment when he could no longer deny the undeniable. The big deal, based on a perception at the time, he's going to conclude species are not immutable. That means species can change. Because up to then, a lot of people were saying, this species is this species and that's all it could ever be. And he's going to say, no, I think this bigger anteater is related to this smaller anteater. I want you to keep in mind what we're thinking about here. The name of his book is Origin of Species. And just watch this as it goes through. Then on the finches, later he says, transmutation of species, later diary entry, had been greatly struck from about the previous March with the character of South American fossils and species on Galapagos Archipelago. These facts, especially the latter on the Galapagos, origin all my views. I don't know why I'm having such trouble here tonight. Let me see if I can get up here and make sure not to touch any of the wrong things. I'm going to need a tech person up here because I need to keep moving. All right, thanks. All right, here's our finches. Maybe that's, is it working now? Here's our finches. If you're going to crack open a nut, Which fence is going to be better suited for that? This one. If you need to get a little bug that's down in a hole in a tree, which fence is going to be better at it? See B up there with that little skinny beak? He's going to be better at that. And so naturally that's what they're going to do. And if you have an environment, say, where there's lots of nuts, maybe this kind of fence is obviously going to do better. If you have one where there's lots of little insects, that one would do better if you've got such environments around. Compare it to when you were in high school. Did you have some guys that were built more for jumping hurdles? Did you have some guys that were built more for playing linebacker? If you're built for playing linebacker, you're probably not going to spend a whole lot of time running the hurdles compared to the guy that's built for that, and vice versa. How are we looking? All right, arrow keys, that'll work. All right. So he wrote the book on the origin of species by means of natural selection. At the end of the book, this is all it says about the evolution of man. At the end of the book, it said, in the future, I see open fields for more important researches like on the origin of man. But that's all it said about that in his first book. In the introduction, he talks about the view that most naturalists until recently entertained, and which I formerly entertained, that each species had been independently created, is erroneous. I am fully convinced that species are not immutable. Now, here's his argument. And just like tomorrow night, I want us to understand their argument. His argument is this. Chapter 1. In domestication, we have a lot of variety. Think about your dogs. See how wide, from a Dalmatian to a Husky to a Chihuahua, that almost doesn't count, but he's there. Apologies to Chihuahua owners. How much variety you can have in dogs, and that they've been bred that way. Well, think on the farm. Some of you are farmers probably or grew up on a farm. Think of how we have different breeds and lines of sheep or cattle or different things. Well, he studied that, and he was very familiar with it. And so he wrote a chapter about variation under domestication. Then, variation under nature, struggle for existence, and natural selection. So it goes like this. In domestication, you've got lots of varieties, like on pigs, say. You've got this pig, this pig, this pig. All these different types of pigs, but they're still pigs. But farmers, by selective breeding, can get emphasis this way or that. Chapter 2, he said you've also got variation in nature. Yes, that's right. Chapter 3, he pointed out there's a struggle for existence, that too many animals are born to be able to compete with all the resources, and not everybody's going to survive. There are forces in nature that are going to eliminate some. And so he says, who's more likely to survive? Natural selection or survival of the fittest. So who's going to survive? Somebody might not make it, while some others do. That's kind of the idea in the book. Here's the fundamental flaw. He said, I can see no limit to the amount of change. And that's where he messed up. Let's go back to the farm. Can you alter the appearance of a pig greatly through breeding? Like, think of a wild pig and how hairy they are. And think of some domestic pigs, how almost completely bald they are. Think of different birds and different things that people have bred. But they're still pigs. They're still pigeons. They're still chickens. If you're breeding an animal, there is a limit to what you can get. And that's going to be so whether you're in on the farm or whether you're out in nature, because you're working with the DNA for a chicken or you're working for the DNA for a pig. Darwin said, Slow though the process of selection may be, a feeble man could do as much by his powers of artificial selection, I can see no limit to the amount of change, to the beauty and infinite complexity, blah, blah, et cetera, in a long course of time by nature's power of selection. What I want you to understand tonight is both what his argument is, but also why this is where he missed the boat on it. Because there is a limit. And we don't need to be defending that species never changed, because as you're going to find out in a few minutes, species can be defined very, very arbitrarily. And one year, scientists will say this is a species and this is a species, and another year they'll change it. And one scientist wants to say these things are different species, and maybe another scientist wants to say they're the same species. So it's kind of arbitrary. So we don't need to be defending that what somebody calls species has to be what God created in the beginning. What do we defend? Genesis didn't say God created them according to their whatever we call a species. It said he created them to reproduce after their what? Kind. And I don't think that that meant five different kinds of rattlesnakes in California and that type of thing. All right, let's proceed now as we go through. There's our finches again. Naturally, I completely agree, and I think you would too, that all of those came from a granddaddy and a grandmama finch way, 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 way back somewhere, right? But to jump from that and say that all of the following have a common ancestor is ridiculous. From a palm tree to a penguin to a python to a petunia to a panther to a pepper to a pachyderm to a peanut to a porpoise to a pineapple, to a person and a pony. And say that they all evolved from a common ancestor. No, you can't do that. You don't have the DNA in there for those things. So the assumption previously was each species fixed and immutable. Observation, a plurality of species, such as finches, could arise from one ancestral species. Conclusion, species are not fixed and immutable. Extended conclusion. If species are not immutable, then all species have a common descent. That's the mistake. Species does not equal basic kinds. When variations within a kind are termed species, then of course such species would be variable. Finches, cockroaches, rattlesnakes, dogs. We're going to talk about dogs and coyotes here in just a minute. But let's go with breeding canines. It's easy to tell what's different there. But let's go back and suppose nobody had bred the dachshund yet. Could you select dogs to breed over generations until you came up with the dachshund? You might not get it done in your lifetime, but breeders after you, you could get that done. Somebody did. Or could you breed a dog to have long, tall legs? Yeah, that's no problem. How many years of breeding would it take to breed a dog that looks like the third one? It's not an issue of time anymore, because it's not a dog. It's a cold-blooded reptile with an external shell. It's something totally different. You don't have the DNA there for that. And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about difference in kinds, for example. Chickens. Chickens have been bred with really, really long tails, really wide legs, long legs, short legs. But no matter how long you breed chickens, you could get all sorts of variety. But how long would you have to breed chickens till you could breed a chicken that looked like that? Again, you just can't do that. You might recognize him from last night, by the way. All right, talking about species. Classification, and underneath species are subspecies. And because it gets kind of arbitrary and fine-tuned, Darwin would say sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between species and subspecies, and I can understand that. Let's go through here and illustrate how this works. It's kind of like playing 20 questions. I'm going to put an animal up here. Some of you may know what this animal is, Ursus americanus. If you know what that is, raise your hand. Just out of curiosity. Okay, a number of you know what Ursus Americanus is. Those of you don't, you're about to find out. It's kind of like playing 20 questions. You're eliminating things as you go through and come through each classification. All right? If it's in the category of life, then it's not going to be, for example, a rock. And if it's in this next domain, then it's not going to be bacteria. And if it's animalia, then it's not going to be a plant. If it's chordata, it's not going to be an invertebrate like a worm. If it's a mammal, it's not going to be a fish or a bird. If it's carnivore, it's not going to be something like a deer. And you keep coming down, and you eventually get to, there it is, it's the American black bear. Now, how many species are there? This is from Science Daily 10 years ago, and I'm going to show you a more updated answer in just a minute. 10 years ago, everybody just pick a number in your head of how many species you might think there are. All right? Answer. Correct answer is somewhere between 2 million and 100 million. So a bunch of you are right. Since then, some people have narrowed it down. 2011, one study said it predicts 8.7 million, plus or minus 1.3 million. And that's a prediction because 86% of species on Earth and 91% of species in the ocean still haven't been identified. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that they're expecting to find all kind of Loch Ness monsters and yetis, you know, going around? What this means is they expect to find another variety of stickleback fish or another variation of this particular starfish or another every once in a while they find something, you know, quite new. But most of the time it's or another beetle, okay? In fact, beetles dominate it. Here's all the species that have been described, pardon me. All the species that have been described. Beetles are 22% of all species. This is including plants and animals. I mean, there's your plants over there. Plants get wiped out just by the beetles themselves. By the time you add in flies and wasps and butterflies and moths and other insects, most all species are insects. So if you can picture somebody finding, oh, look at this ladybug, and it's a little bit different, and if you identify it as a new species, and that type of thing. We're going to look now at dogs. What's the difference between a dog and a wolf? God didn't create, and I don't think Adam had on the ark, a miniature French poodle, you know, with the fluffy up here and the shaved here and then the little bald tail and stuff. That's a canine, and it's been bred to look that particular way. Dalmatians are bred to look the way they are. There's sometimes, though, difficulties in breeding. Because of the inbreeding and stuff, sometimes you have weaknesses. And so a particular breed might be prone to, like, deafness or hip problems or such. But the wolf is a natural canine that has not been bred by man. What's the difference between a wolf and a coyote? They categorize the wolf as Canis lupus. In the canine family, species lupus. They categorize the coyote, Canis latrans. Here's some subspecies. There's a wolf, Canis lupus, and there's a coyote, Canis latrans. Underneath wolf, you've got all sorts of subspecies. Well, here's my question. Should these be considered different species or the same? When I was in high school, those were three different species. Canis lupus was a wolf, Canis latrans was a coyote, and a dog was Canis familiaris. In 1993, they changed it, and I think they're right to. Scientific name for dog is now Canis lupus. Subspecies familiaris. So this is now the same species as a wolf, which makes sense. Can it breed with a wolf? Yes, it can. Can a coyote breed with a wolf? Yes. And so, Alan, I may have you take over here for me in a minute. We went over these, and I knew if my throat got too bad, I might ask Alan to do that. So be ready in just a minute if I can't make it through this. Name the animals in this picture. I would say that's a wolf chasing coyote. Scientifically, it is lupus chasing latrons. I would say that's a dog chasing a dog. Scientifically, that's a lupus chasing a lupus. That's a couple of wolves, you know, running around. That's what it is. But coyotes have hybridized with wolves, and coyotes have hybridized with dogs. So why should they be considered a separate species? Well, they usually don't interbreed, but they're capable of interbreeding. Putting all this together, and like here, which of those is what? Well, that's a husky, that's a wolf, and this is a combination of both Malamute and wolves. Lastly, microevolution and macroevolution. I was reading today, I looked up on Wikipedia, and it talked about creationists try to make a big deal about micro and macroevolution, which is big evolution and little evolution. It said it's really the same thing, just on a different scale. No, there's a difference. And we'll illustrate some of this. Everybody's heard of the peppered moths in England. The peppered moths in England, before the Industrial Revolution, tended to be white or light-colored. There was a variety that would be dark, but there weren't as many of them. The trees would sometimes have lichen on them, which was light-colored. But then after the Industrial Revolution, the lichen started dying off and stuff started getting soot on it, perhaps, and so the forest was darker. And so the idea is this, that beforehand, this variety of the peppered moth was better camouflaged, and this was easier to see. So if you're a bird and you're looking for lunch, which one is easier to spot? After the Industrial Revolution, this was easier to not be seen, and that was easier to see. And what they found when they went out in the woods was they found a different ratio of moths. Now, assuming that they were being able to spot them all or something, I'm assuming their facts are correct that the ratio did change, and that would make sense. When they enacted some cleaner air legislation, the numbers started coming back the other way. And this is often put forward as proof of evolution. Well, it is certainly a change. But they're both still what? Moths. In fact, they're both still peppered moths. And it's not that the moth changed to fit the environment. It's that the ratio changed because of a predator. Sometimes they'll talk about, they act as almost like it's a choice directed by, you know, this moth or something, in the language used. But let me give a correlation. In World War II in Germany, before World War II, there were a lot of Jews compared to Aryans in Germany. Then a predator came along and eliminated a lot of Jewish people and a lot of gypsies and a lot of other people and changed the ratio of people. Does that mean they've evolved into a better people or something like that? No, it means somebody came through and eliminated a lot of people. And so this, the ratio changed, but you still have dark moths and light moths. Roger Lewin, very interesting evolutionist writer. I've got a book of his that I really like. He also wrote a book for the Smithsonian Institution. This is a number of years ago, back in 1981. And he's an evolutionary writer, and he's reporting in the journal Science about a conference in Chicago challenging the 4-decade-long dominance of modern synthesis, and they're talking about macroevolution. The question was whether or not microevolution can be extrapolated to explain macroevolution. And this is what he said. At the risk of doing violence to the positions of some of the people at the meeting, a clear answer can be the answer can be given as a clear no. Species do indeed have a capacity to undergo minor modifications in their physical and other characteristics. But do you see what it says? This is limited. Then he quotes various evolutionists like Stephen Joe Gold, who had proposed the punctuated equilibrium just a few years before. He and Eldridge both. Macroevolution is not simply microevolution extrapolated. Macroevolution is decoupled from microevolution. In the top one, macroevolution should be decoupled from microevolution. Now, a lot of people still will say that it's the same thing just on a bigger scale, but it's not so. This, can you start with peppered moths and change the ratio because the environment changes? Yes. Can you get different variety of finches from some ancestral finches, more extreme in different directions? Yes. Can you have wingless beetles on a windy owl? We'll talk about that in a minute. Yes. But does that explain getting from a single cell to all of those? No. I'd like to recommend, if you want to see some this type of point being made on a university campus and before some professors, and talking to some professors, it's kind of interesting. There's a fellow named Ray Comfort who did a movie. It's on YouTube, Evolution versus God. It's 38 minutes, and it's kind of interesting to watch. I think you'll find it enjoyable. But aside from what we've already talked about, here's this. Survival of the fittest does not account for the arrival of the fittest. Secondly, even more fundamentally, none of that explains how life came about in the first place. The big, big jump in evolutionary theory is when you go from a bunch of just lifeless minerals to life. That's a huge jump. Lots of later jumps are not that big compared to that huge jump there. This theory does not explain that, how life came about in the first place. After Darwin, you had the synthetic theory. They didn't understand genetics at the time. I'm not going to claim to understand about genetics. I'm not a geneticist. But Gregor Mendel had done his work over in Brno in the Czech Republic, and they learned from that, and then they seized upon mutation as an accepted mechanism in the 1900s, was focused on, and still today, mechanism for introducing improvements. There's a problem with relying on mutations as your mechanism for improvement. We'll talk about that in just a second. In the 70s, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge came up with the punctuated equilibrium thing. Stephen Stanley was always so part of that, which Darwin had insisted there was just gradual. And then Gould and Eldridge and stuff pointed out things in the fossil record have remarkable stasis. They just stay the same, and then suddenly there's a change. Now, when they say suddenly, they don't mean in one generation. They mean over thousands and thousands of years as opposed to other. But one of the reasons for this was because they said the fossil record doesn't support all this. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould said he didn't say there were no transitional forms down through there, but he said the extreme rarity of transitional forms were a trade secret of paleontology. On the idea of mutations, we've got movies now, X-Men. You know, it's like, oh, I'm a mutant. What superpower do you have? That's not really how real life works. You know, if you are a farmer and you've got some very expensive cattle breeds, and then you paid a lot to have this bull come in and sire some of your cattle and everything, and you say, oh, I'm afraid we've got your offspring is mutated. You don't go, what superpowers do my cows have now? You know, That's not good news. But there are cases in which, under specific situations, a mutation may be beneficial in a certain situation, like sickle cell anemia. That's not a good thing. It's where your blood cells, instead of being healthy like this, they're more sickle celled and they don't hold stuff as well. But if you're in an area where a malaria plague comes through, it's kind of nice to not have something going through you so much. Otherwise, it's not so beneficial of a thing. But here's an example. There's on an island over in the Atlantic, over towards the other side, toward Africa or Mediterranean area, somewhere around over in there, there's an island with wingless beetles. And we would assume that maybe their ancestors had wings. But it's a small island and it's windy. So let's just imagine your beetles and you're flying around on the island. Okay, not a very big island. And one day you say, I'm going to go for a flight. And off you go. And it's not too windy, so you make it where you're going. What if a big gust of wind comes? You're off the island, right? And splash, boom, and that's the end of that beetle. Once he's gone, he can't reproduce his beetle genes anymore. Well, over time, guess what? The beetles that are flying around have been, which beetles are left? The wingless beetles. So on that particular small windy island, it kind of pays not to be able to fly because you can get blown away and land in the ocean. But notice that's not added information. That's a loss of information. Okay? You've seen people who have lost their legs and maybe they're in a wheelchair. Well, if a psychotic killer comes in, he starts mowing people down that are standing up, he may be fortunate that he'll survive that. It doesn't mean it's a generally beneficial thing that's happened to him, but there are circumstances in which he may survive better. And so in this case, note that it's a loss of information. Some of you may remember this. Raise your hand if you know what that is. Young people, many years ago, I actually sat around and played this a few times. In fact, I think I played it several times. This is an airplane game. And you would take your little controller, and you didn't have 3D motion, it was 2D, and you could move your little World War I biplane around, and you could shoot at the other ones. And you see the bullet coming out, and you could hear a little sound. And so one guy's flying this way, and it was, at the time, it was great fun, I guess. Now, today, we've still got games where you can play World War I flying games. Now they look a bit more like this, right? And they have all sorts of features. You would be able to look backwards, look forward, you know, see from above you, maybe see from the ground. If you crash, you might be able to replay and watch the whole thing happen. You'd be able to plan, you know, your attacks. All sorts of things that can happen. I want you to imagine a series of mutations getting from this to this. You make a computer game for a simple little Atari thing. And you're making copies, making copies, making copies, making copies. But as you're making copies, there a few mistakes are made and it drops a little bit of information or something. Or some, you know, something doesn't get copied correctly. So you have a corrupted copy. Is that going to make it a better computer game or a worse game? It's going to be worse. But if there's enough different changes in the computer code, maybe sometime one of those changes would be beneficial. And then, which one would people want to copy? That one. And then you have some more, you know, just, you know, let's say that while you're doing the computer code, the cat crawls across the keyboard, you know, and so you have these mutations. Is that a way to get from that to that? No. That takes planning. That takes intelligence to get that kind of added information. It's your cat crawling across your keyboard while you're loading a computer program does not make it better. Mutations is a silly way to look for all of this to have developed. So concluding, here's these two different belief systems. Nobody saw God create man. None of us did. Nobody saw chemicals turn into life. What we see is what is here and now. And what we see here and now, we can make conclusions on. Just like if you went home tonight, and I don't know why the window is that color, but it is. If you went home tonight and you found your window broken, you would wonder why it broke, correct? Well, let's suppose you look at the ground. Now, can you make a reasonable conclusion about why your window is broken? Did you see a little boy playing baseball? No, but you see a ball that's not yours, and it's in the house, and you see a broken window. What's the logical conclusion? The ball came through the window. Even though you didn't see it happen, by looking at what is here now, you make a conclusion. Opposed to that, let's suppose this is what you find. There's no ball, but also your TV is gone. Now are you going to assume, hey, I think there were some boys playing ball outside. No, you're going to draw a very different conclusion. So you look at what's here now, and then you make a logical conclusion about the past. What's here now? As we saw last night, we exist. We are alive. And we exhibit design. How? Why? And remember those three self-evident facts from last night. Nothing comes from nothing. So since something's here now, something's always been here. Life comes from life. So we didn't come from something inanimate. We came from a source of life. An intelligent design comes from an intelligent designer. Which brings us back to that principle of Romans 1:20. The invisible things of God can be clearly seen by looking at what he made. Tomorrow night, we'll be looking at the argument from the line of Neanderthals and those type of things. Thank you for your good attention tonight. And if you are subject to the gospel invitation, won't you come before your Lord this evening as we stand and sing.